On 88.1 Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region. In last week's episode, we examined Baltimore's high rate of vacancy, most visible in low-income neighborhoods. Today, in this third episode of The Lines Between Us, we continue to focus on neighborhoods, but specifically neighborhood diversity. We're going to look at two areas in Baltimore and their history of racial integration. Assistant producer Jamila Kay has this report.
Although the Federal Fair Housing Act was enacted in 1968, it took decades for racial integration to be evident in some of Baltimore's neighborhoods. And even now, few communities reflect true diversity, which is to say, people of various ages, races, classes, cultures, religions, sexual orientations, and identities living together. At the most basic level, community diversity starts with individuals having access to live in any community they choose and crossing the invisible boundaries that divide neighborhoods. Starting in the mid-1950s, black families began moving into the West Baltimore neighborhood of Edmondson Village, which at the time had a predominantly white population. In 1965, Inez Haney Dodson was newly divorced and moved her four children into a row home just off of Edmondson Avenue. Haney Dodson is 74 now. A few weeks ago, she drove me through her old neighborhood where she said racial integration was short-lived.
When I moved in my home, I think I was the sixth black family to move there in that block. Shortly after I moved here, for sale signs began growing up. Well, there were for sale signs when I moved here. But the neighborhood changed very, very rapidly.
How so?
Whites moved out and blacks moved in.
And in some cases, black residents were not offered the same types of mortgages as their white neighbors.
Were you familiar with the term blockbusting?
Yes.
Did you see some of that going on? Are black residents getting loans that were not as fair as their white counterparts?
I have one.
You did?
Yes.
Did you know that you were getting a loan like that?
No, well, it was called renting with the option to buy. Mm-hmm. I bought my home for $10,900, and you were buying it like rent, so you didn't get the deed to the house at that time. You allegedly owned the home, but if you wanted something done, you couldn't get it done because it wasn't yours. But, you know, I had no money. I needed a place to raise the children, so I probably paid for it. It was paid for, and I got the deed in about 18 years. I finished paying for it in 1982. I bought it in 65. Well, I got it in 65.
In the late 80s, Haney Dodson moved into a home just outside of Edmondson Village. In 2020, black residents made up 97% of Edmondson Village's population. The rapid shift in racial demographics occurred in a 10-year span from 1955 to 1965. So, in summary, first, no racial diversity, then a brief period of integration, and now, a lack of diversity yet again. But just across town, Southeast Baltimore is being called the most diverse community in the city, a large part of that distinction due to the area's large Hispanic population. Signs for Spanish-owned businesses dot Eastern Avenue and Broadway Street. This wasn't always the case, says Evelyn Rosario, a 39-year-old Fells Point resident who moved to the area in 1991. Standing a block from the Esperanza Center, where she works as a community service manager, Rosario says she watched the area change in demographics and in development.
I still remember walking down Broadway, and we are in Broadway right now, and it didn't look as nice, as vibrant, as, you know, people walking and doing businesses. The first home that we bought was at 18 South Washington Street. It was not brand new. It needed a lot of work, but we worked on it. We made it pretty. I remember I had a white couple with a young little boy living next door. And the other homes were kind of mixed, but there were not a lot of Latinos. For some reason, Latinos were not thinking of really staying or living in this area at that point. I think that people liked the county areas because maybe it was a little bit more, they thought maybe it was more safer. I mean, for us was more like, okay, this is what we can afford and this is where we can not just give up a rent. This is something that we're working towards, you know, future, and it paid off.
Rosario says economic opportunity and the community's diversity are some of the reasons she has stayed to watch things change.
I think that now it's more mostly as a melting pot, and I like it. I think it's very, very nice to have the opportunity to meet people not from my own country, but from other countries. I think I've learned a lot from them too, as well as probably they learn from me. I'm not too afraid of people. I think that maybe it's just me, or maybe just I'm naive. I think that everyone has something good. And, you know, we never really look at people because of their color or something like that. It was, you know, my neighbors, let's meet them. Baltimore has been really welcoming to me, to my family. We have had opportunities and we have taken opportunities. And I think not every place that you live, you're able to have that.
Baltimore has been suffering from a population decline for decades, but new people are coming in, and those who fled are coming back. And there are generations of residents who have never left. Perhaps a rise in population will increase diversity. Only time will tell. 8 years, to be exact. You don't need to wait until the 2020 census, though. Just look around. Who are your neighbors?
Maryland Morning Assistant Producer Jamila Kay. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cass. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. We just heard from two Baltimore City residents who witnessed the changing racial demographics of their neighborhoods. Now we have several guests in our studio to discuss the history of racial integration in some Baltimore communities. Dr. Ed Orser wrote the book on one West Baltimore neighborhood, literally. He's the author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, The Edmondson Village Story. Dr. Orser, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we're also joined by Glenn Ross, community organizer and president of the McElderry Park Neighborhood Association. Glenn Ross, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And also with us is Baltimore City Councilman Jim Kraft, who represents District 1, which includes Patterson Park, Upper Fells Point, and Canton. Councilman Kraft, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Orser, I'll start with you. Inez discussed in the first segment how she saw homes on her street go from being occupied by mostly white residents to mostly black residents. What was the trend she was witnessing? This was blockbusting.
I wouldn't say that blockbusting caused the kind of change that happened, but it certainly accelerated it, and it left people victims on both sides. But Inez speaks about the victimization of black purchasers who very often could not get loans through mainstream banks. In fact, most typically couldn't. So only could get the loan to buy the house through the blockbuster or through the agent. Nobody called themselves a blockbuster, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm careful about that term is that people who were engaged in this enterprise, their defense was they were making housing available to African Americans and others in a situation where they had been totally excluded. So that was a reality.
And why do you say victims on both sides?
Well, I think whites were victimized too, and I think one could say they victimized themselves, and that needs to be said, of course. But the panic that resulted in this kind of situation meant that many sold their houses way, way below what the houses were worth, and for many, that was the only equity they had. That was their sort of life saving. And for them, it was something out of control. And they fled.
Before all this happened, was Edmondson Village a middle class neighborhood?
This was a sort of, I think, upper working class, lower middle class community. And I point out in the book that African Americans who moved in actually very closely resembled those same characteristics.
Councilman Kraft, let's talk about Patterson Park. I'm not sure whether it's a similar or different pattern there. Historically, Patterson Park was white blue-collar residents.
Right.
Right.
Very ethnic. And yet the neighborhoods over there have pretty much retained a lot of the ethnicity. We see today a change in the diversity. The ethnicity we see today is more Latino. That's happened over the last probably 10 to 15 years, but not in the same with the same mechanisms that were there in place then.
I'm trying to understand what was the driving force in making the Patterson Park area more diverse than blue-collar whites?
A lot of the folks just moved.
Because
they got older. And the other thing is they got a little more money. So they moved, they migrated eastward. So if you took like Little Italy as an example, you had the Italian families there that moved from Little Italy and then they moved to Highland Town. Most of the folks that lived in the neighborhood and continue to live in the neighborhood until really the industrial plants really started closing up.
So was there a period when you had actually coexisting white residents and black residents?
Oh, we did, but some of that happened when they tore down some of the public housing over on the west side. I think it was the Murphy Homes, and that caused probably the biggest shift in the racial dynamic in Highland Town and Patterson Park, probably in the last 30 to 40 years.
And how would you describe the racial dynamic then?
If you talk to folks who lived in the neighborhood then, they would say that the city blockbusted their neighborhood. I mean, they would say that when the city took city housing, infill housing that the city owned or the city had control over, and moved the folks from the Murphy Homes into those vacant houses, that had this almost the same effect as when the folks that were doing block busting in the Edmondson Village area or some of these other areas of the city.
Glenn Ross, you grew up in Southeast Baltimore, right?
No, I grew up in East Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
But went to school in Southeast Baltimore, played down in Patterson Park. This would be my second time of experiencing this. Once as a child, then I have an opportunity, unfortunately, to see it again. I moved 500 block north Milton Avenue in 1980 as a single parent with two children. So,
and I want to ask you about that, but reflect back a little further. What do you remember from the 60s, 70s?
Well, it was all white community. I do remember that when I was a kid in junior high school, everything south of Eaker Street was Highland Town. But as minorities moved in, Highland Town boundaries moved. But it was always a predominantly white community. And when I moved in, I expected a little racial confrontation. You know, I mean, it wasn't that bad. But we also saw white flight. But I think what people didn't understand is that we that moved in that area as African American, we came from working class families. We came from neighborhoods that family values, community pride. And I strongly believe that if the white flight wasn't as high as what it was, those neighborhoods would have been able to stabilize a lot longer. But then when they started tearing down public housing, what we realized is that these property owners that couldn't get the $500-$600 a month rent, they can now get $1,200 a month for Section 8. Now, I'm not seeing anything wrong with Section 8 or Section 8 people, but you know, when you have generations of people who have grew up in public housing, they live in a different living environment. So when people move into neighborhoods like McGeldry Park or Bel Air Edison, when you have generations of people coming from out of public housing, they don't come with lawnmowers, weed whackers. That doesn't happen. What I've noticed was that a lot of working African Americans started moving out the community.
So it wasn't just white flight?
No, it wasn't just white flight.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. Ed Orser, author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, The Edmondson Village Story. Baltimore City Councilman Jim Kraft, who represents much of Southeast Baltimore, and Glenn Ross, the president of the McGeldry Park Neighborhood Association, we're speaking about the factors that have led to demographic changes in some Baltimore neighborhoods. Councilman Kraft, what do you see in terms of a disconnect among Southeast residents?
The majority of my district is white, and I have a pretty stable, if not declining, African-American population. My African-American community that I have is pretty segregated for lack of a better word. And the African-American population that I do have is professional, socioeconomically the same as the socioeconomic level, and it has just blended in. There's really no distinction. The conflict really in my district is in two areas. It's in the greater Highland Town area, where we have the growing Hispanic-Latino population, and in the Broadway corridor, where it pushes up against the old ethnic neighborhoods in Upper Fells Point and Fells Prospect. It's not in anger. It's not in violence. It's it is just in frustration. You have folks that are older who have been in the community for generations. You have folks that have just moved in. There's language difference, cultural difference. It's exciting. The diversity is exciting. And once the folks get to know one another, the neighborhoods are working well together. It's just that initial stress of, you know, the unknown between them.
As much homage as we pay to the idea of diversity, at least some people do, Glenn Ross, do communities do enough to make diversity work? I mean, is there more that the communities need to do?
Well, I strongly feel that those better affluent neighborhoods get more resources to work with to do that. But I really point my finger at our city government. As Councilman Kraft said 10, 15 years ago is when we start seeing the movement of a lot of Latinos moving in, you know, and within that time period, people in public housing, and it's a terrible disconnect. And I personally feel that if the city knew that you have the large population of Hispanics moving in the neighborhood, people that come from different living environments, the city should have created some type of program to help create some type of culture exchange type program to make that transition much easier. I just want to use that as an example real quick. We have a Latino supermarket on the corner of Monument, Orleans, okay? Mm-hmm. And this is the fifth owner. He's having the same problems as the first four. They're selling food that's in Spanish. You know, they lose money, you know, so we don't speak Spanish. They have fruits and vegetables. We don't know if it's a fruit or vegetable. So the city should help create, and will help us to create, culture exchange type programs where we can start working and living together.
Well, let me ask Councilman. I was going to ask you, Councilman Kraft, what the community should do, but Mr. Ross raises the question of what the city needs to do to make diversity work.
A good number of my schools now, the elementary schools, the majority of the children in the elementary schools, or close to the majority of the children in the elementary school, are Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so we really need bilingual teachers, bilingual administrators, and we don't have the number that we need. So we really need...
Don't have the number of the percentage of...
The percentage of teachers, percentage of administrators that we need to adequately serve those children.
We've been talking about diverse communities at different socioeconomic levels. I mean, there's a fair amount of affluence in Patterson Park these days. That's not true of all the communities we've been talking about. How does diversity play out differently in neighborhoods with higher incomes compared to lower incomes?
Well, I was thinking back to what I'd said about blockbusting, that part of what was so distressing about its impact and the impact of that period of just massive racial change was that everything happened too fast. And I think when we've seen things slow down, and Glenn and Jim both were talking about examples when you have neighbors begin to talk to neighbors, when you have neighbors joining one another in a community association, and when you have it not unusual for there to be people of different races at the table or next door. That, I think, is such a wonderful step. And I think we've seen some of that happening in the aftermath, but it's taken a while to settle down. And I think it's now, you know, if we really look at the daily interactions that many of us have, it's not unusual to have interaction across racial lines, whereas it was so totally unusual in the 60s and before. So I think anything that kind of slows it down, that has people joining together about parks, about schools, about neighborhoods, those are where we have common interest and where we do see some real interaction.
Well, I appreciate you all talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Ed Orser, author of Blockbusting in Baltimore, The Edmondson Village Story. Glenn Ross, president of the McElderry Park Neighborhood Association, and City Councilman Jim Kraft, who represents much of Southeast Baltimore. For an extended version of this interview, visit linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Coming up, Tom Hall and two church leaders examine the role of religious institutions in increasing diversity. We got the news yesterday that Clarence Mitchell III died at the age of 72. He fought for equal rights in Maryland's legislature, and he comes from an extended family, including Lily Carol Jackson, Juanita Jackson Mitchell, and his father, Clarence Mitchell Jr., that was at the forefront throughout the 20th century of the effort to ensure equality under the law for all people. We extend our condolences to his family.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, the Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Morning, 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long series on inequality in the Baltimore region. This week, we've been talking about diversity and the history of integration in some Baltimore communities. In many neighborhoods, churches, synagogues, and other houses of worship have played a role in increasing diversity. But along with the history of promoting racial equality, some religious institutions also have a history of exclusion. In a few moments, we'll hear about the efforts to increase diversity from the perspective of two church leaders. Earlier this morning, we heard from Inez Haney Dodson. She talked about moving into Edmondson Village in West Baltimore in 1965, which at the time had a predominantly white population. Inez also broke the color line at St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church on Edmondson Avenue.
I began here in March of 1965, and I looked in the yellow pages of the phone book, and I saw 4711 at Edmondson Avenue. So I said, oh, that's where we'll go. I did not know when I came here that I was going to be in integrating the church. I didn't know, you know, I'd been away for 2 years, and I had heard of such changes in civil rights while I was in Germany. So I really didn't know. I just knew that it was close and we needed an Episcopal church that was close by. I imagine I must have come on the 15th of March because the march to Selma was on March 8th of 1965. And the rector, who was here at the time, preached on the march to Selma. He had been one of those who stood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, standing up for and walking for civil rights. I imagine when I took communion, I realized that there were no other people of color here. So I decided in my own mind that as soon as the service was over, I would be making a hasty exit and I probably would not be back. After the service, I was surrounded. I mean, people came over to greet me. One of whom still goes here, and she sits with me now. She's 93. They knew I was coming back. I didn't plan on coming back. They just made me feel so comfortable. I knew that everyone wouldn't welcome me, and I didn't expect everyone to. I just expected to be treated with respect.
Next month, St. Bartholomew's Church on Edmondson Avenue and the Church of the Holy Trinity in the nearby West Baltimore neighborhood of Bridgeview Greenlawn are participating in a race and reconciliation workshop under the auspices of the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland. Joining me on the phone is the rector of St. Bartholomew's, Reverend Florence Ledyard, and here in the studio, the rector of Holy Trinity, Reverend Eddie Blue. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Reverend Ledyard, let me start with you. Inez, whom we just heard from, is still a parishioner at St. Bartholomew's, so she's one of your parishioners. Set the scene for us before Inez joined the church in 1965. What was the church's path to integration at that point?
St. Bartholomew's Church was formed as a congregation just prior to the Civil War. The church building was not built until after the Civil War was over, and it was located down on North Avenue. When that community began to change color, the congregation chose to move out to its present location here on Edmondson Avenue. When this community started to change color, this congregation, in a moment of absolute clarity, got a grip on the gospel and made a singularly profound decision to stay exactly where they were and to become a part of a community in transition.
And Reverend Eddie Blue, how about the history of the Church of the Holy Trinity? Yours is an African-American congregation. What's its journey been so far?
Well, we were founded in 1953. There was a white congregation that inhabited our building named Holy Trinity. And when our neighborhood began to change in the late 40s, early 50s, they decided not to integrate, essentially, and to close and to deed their building to the Diocese of Maryland for the establishment of a black congregation. And we had our first worship service the first Sunday in October 1953.
And there's an extraordinary thing, at least it's extraordinary to me. There is a commission on truth and reconciliation that Bishop Eugene Sutton, the bishop of the Diocese of Baltimore of Maryland, has given a directive for churches to do something that talks about the history and talks about the dynamics of race relations. So your churches are participating in a racial reconciliation workshop. It's next month. It's called Seeing the Face of God in Each Other. Reverend Ledyard, this is really even the title of this is sort of redolent of South Africa and the commissions on race and reconciliation, you know, in the post-apartheid era. What do you hope to accomplish in this?
I hope that this allows an opportunity for our congregations to continue to be intentional about addressing issues of racism, and then to continue to be able to find ways to explore ways to attend to issues of race and the ways that we can counterbalance that and find much more redemptive opportunities for a radical welcome that is gracious and full of hope and full of potential.
And Reverend Blue, your perspective as the leader of a black Episcopal church, what do you hope to achieve?
I think what I would like to see happen is for our two communities to forge a vision of how we're going to live together as people of faith who are of different races and yet have a common love and affection for God, and how that love and affection for God can work itself out in our relationships as Episcopalians, as people who inhabit different parishes, but who still have a common vision for what the world can be like. When Flo and I sat down to talk about this, we had envisioned it as something that would involve only our congregations, and it's been expanded to include people from all over the diocese. It's a training that will be open to anybody who wants to participate.
On 88.1, it's The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, speaking on the phone with Reverend Florence Ledyard, and here in the studio with the Reverend Eddie Blue about the role of religious institutions in bridging divides in communities. Reverend Blue, Dr. King rather famously said that the 10 and 11 o'clock hour on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. But what about the fact that there is a great utility and a great positive dimension to churches, different church communities, continuing their particular traditions? We have the Greek Orthodox or the Eastern European Church, the various branches of Judaism, for example. You have an African-American church. I'm sure diversity is a good thing, but so is upholding the traditions of African-American culture within the larger context of Christianity and in your case, Episcopalianism. How do you balance the tension between those two? Is there a tension in your mind between those two?
There isn't, in that if one thinks of all cultures as at least being part of creation or having been created by God, then certainly we can affirm cultures other than our own. We have an obligation, I think, to generations that succeed us to maintain our culture.
Let me ask both of you the same question. Reverend Lidar, we'll start with you. Is it your strategic intention, your hope, to attract to St. Bartholomew's more people of color for your congregation? Right now, your congregation is predominantly white.
Correct. Although we are, in fact, a true multicultural congregation, but we do remain predominantly white. Although we do, in fact, strategically, we have a strategic plan and vision that is trying to intentionally create an environment and a faith community that will embrace more and more diversity.
And Reverend Blue, let me ask you the same question. Is it your strategic intention and hope to attract white people and people who aren't of African heritage?
I'll tell you a little story. When we were looking at our vestry, our leadership council was looking at a way to describe ourselves and the purposes of our congregation. And one of the things that I thought we ought to do is talk about the fact that we were African American, and they resisted that because they want to project our church as a church that's open to all kinds of people. And I think that would be an accurate reflection of who we are. We want to be open to all kinds of people. But at the same time, we want to affirm who we are. I mean, there are right now no white people in our congregation. Unless things change radically in our neighborhood or in the city, they're not likely to be, at least for the foreseeable future. So, you know, we need to affirm who we are, being open to other possibilities, to practice what Flo has already described as a radical welcome.
Reverend Ledyard, we're less than a month away from an election, which will include several referenda, one of which is on the issue of same-sex marriage. The Episcopal Church has been of two minds on this, nationally and internationally. Can you speak about diversity and inclusion in the church that isn't related to race in terms of your perspective from St. Bartholomew's?
The church ought to be a place where we radically welcome everyone and where we recognize that every single human being is created in the image of God. And our ability to welcome within our faith communities people of all kinds of diversity is actually joyous and full of delight. It's not always very simple or very easy. It's sometimes really complicated, but I believe with some degree of intentionality and lots of prayer and lots of conversation that is honest, that ability to welcome within the church every human being, no matter who they are, is critical to our understanding of what the church is and is critical to our understanding of the future of the church.
And Reverend Blue, the clergy have been very much front and center in this issue of marriage equality, many for, some many against. How about for Holy Trinity? Is this an important issue for your congregants?
It's not a burning issue, I would say. I think probably the majority of my congregation is more concerned about the reelection of President Obama than anything else. I've not heard any real concern expressed about marriage equality. I think there have been some concerns expressed about the Dream Act, but none really about that issue.
So have you chosen to preach about it one way or the other?
I've decided not to.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Ledyard, how about you? Are you preaching about it?
I am, actually, just last Sunday.
Well, I appreciate both of you taking the time to speak with us, and best wishes on this workshop on race and reconciliation. Appreciate it, Reverend Eddie Blue and Reverend Florence Ledyard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to more of our conversation and for photos and video of some of our guests this morning, visit thelinesbetweenus.org. and you'll click on all sorts of information related to our conversations in this series. I'm Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, 88.1 WYPR. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.